Some tried to mount. Some tried to hurry their preparations. Some came to the conclusion that there was just no possible way to flee in time, and tried to make their peace with the gods. One thing was certain. That thing, whatever it was, would mow us down before we crossed our own ward of flames. That's the conclusion I came to, at least. And so I calmly led Traveler back to a post and tied him up, then retrieved my warstaff and mage blade from my saddle and walked back to the center of the deserted bailey. If I was going to die, it would be on my feet, fighting. I tried to put on my best defiant sneer. I wasn't surprised to feel Sire Kusi at my shoulder, sword in hand. He couldn't feel the approaching malevolence, but he could read a crowd. One by one my team assembled around me, each one of them preparing spells and clutching witch stones, some drawing swords or doing feats of martial magic in preparation for our last stand. Irianite flashed all around me. Pentandra joined us late. She had figured out what was going on before she came out. I realized that her hair was wet and smelled of aromatic eastern soap. The evil witch had found time to bathe, while I still smelled like a wharf-side bordello the day after the fleet came in. I suppose there are worse ways for a man to die. I felt her fall in line on my other side as the rest of the war magi filed in, and for 2 solid minutes we all just stared at the sky and cast preparatory spells, prayed, and waited. None of the gods we invoked bothered to show up. Wise of them. One of the kids, Rustalo, I believe, was starting to make jokes after the pregnant paws stretched on uncomfortably. That's when I saw it. I wasn't sure exactly what it was, so I hung 5 or so nasty offensive spells and 3 good defensive spells that I had prepared to welcome it. Mine were pretty straightforward. Some of the others I could feel were pretty elaborate. So, at last, our fate approaches, Kusi murmured fatalistically. I hope it ate its biscuits this morning, Azar said dismissively. I'm feeling rowdy. I ignored it. We all knew what was going to happen. Talk first, or hit it with something? Asked Penny quietly. You're asking me. You're the captain, my captain. Once the sex was over, you're in charge again. Crap. As if I didn't have enough to worry about. Let's talk first, I decided. Why? I thought I was captain. Because it might give me time to think of something better to do. Right now, I can't remember my own name. It's Minilan. Captain Minilan, the spellmonger. Lord by right of conquest of Bovol Vale. The spellmonger. Captain Minilan the Great. Now you're just getting silly. Someone began loudly offering prayers to some divinity. Or it could have been an incantation. I wasn't really paying attention. I was looking up. You could see it far off at first, a speck of bright green in the absolute center of the dark black cloud. It illuminated the clouds around it with the pale green glow as it descended with all the speed of a shooting star. It was a terrible thing to behold, an utterly unnatural thing. And I again debated myself whether making a stand was a better idea than blind flight. That thing was moving fast, and was heading right for us. I feared a collision. As it approached the bailey, it slowed down rapidly. Instead of crashing with a thunderclap, it floated down like a hawk preparing to catch a hare. Not a pleasing mental image when you are feeling very much like a hare. The glow intensified, until it outshone the light from our own protective wall. It snapped through our wards like threads, and came to a stop about 4 feet above the ground, 20 paces ahead of us, until I could almost make out what it was, and wasn't. It wasn't a goblin, at least not all of it. It was a sphere, as wide as a large pumpkin, a sphere of clear, flawless Irianite. It was a sphere so translucent that you could see the mummified skull within. The mouth was open in an eternal rictus of pain and rage, and the eyes were sunken and dead. But there was no mistaking the feeling of intelligence that it radiated. The skull was alive. There was a being inside that aberration of nature. Aberration it was. I could feel just how deep an impression on reality it made, as potent in its way as the Molopar had been. As it approached us slowly, It sent shearing waves of distortion just by its very existence. The great ghost, the old god, the dead god, Sherul, the super shaman. All of those names fit. It was dead, no doubt about it. Undead, really. It was clearly the skull of a Gavani shaman, mummified and preserved within the green amber, and gave it all the power a human god could ever dream of. I would have wet myself in fear if I hadn't been so damn dehydrated. I understood a lot now. This had to be the head of Sherul, the great shaman slain by Kusi's ancestors in an act of treachery. Sherul, whose head was removed from the pike they had staked it on and spirited away by the survivors. I could even see the exit wound in the top left of the fossilized skull. His shamanic disciples had apparently taken it deep into the mountains, far away from humans, and somehow had embedded it in the largest chunk of Irianite that had ever been. And then they had somehow awoken him up from the dead, determined to do its bidding, and the bodiless head wanted revenge. "What were you doing in the sacred cave?" came a powerful thought in my head, in a hideous parody of my own voice. It was beyond spooky. "We were allowing our people to escape," I said bravely. "You defiled the sacred cave with your filthy humani feet." "Hey, I wiped my feet before I went in. It was messed up like that when I got here," I explained.
"You used the artifact. You call it a molopar."
"Yeah. Well, you kind of gave us no choice. You put up barriers around the valley."
"Such is my right. I am reclaiming the valley for the Targa Gurvani."
"I'm not disputing that," I agreed, "and we helpfully depopulated it for you.
The Targa Gurvani are not pleased that they will be forced to postpone their vengeance.
There's a lot of people disappointed with how things have worked out." This was not going exactly as planned. I expected to be dead by now, killed in a powerful magical attack. The fact that I was not, yet, gave me a certain stupid confidence in what I was saying. What did I have to lose? I acknowledged that the men who took this veil did so by treachery, committed acts of murder and pillage, and destroyed a valuable religious center. But the people who lived here now, are not the ones who did that. Those men are dead. Take back your valley, your sacred cave. Keep the castle if you want. No extra charge. But leave us in peace.
These are the descendants of those people. Their line bears the stain of their ancestors' crimes.
Then leave that for their own gods to deal with.
I am a god.
A metaphysical subject for another time. But even if you are a god, you are the god of the Gavani, not of men.
The gods of men seem slow to respond.
I've noticed that myself recently. I'll speak to the monks about that if I don't meet a human god myself someday. But the fact remains, you are not a god of men. I was on shaky theological ground here, I'm sure. Theurgy is a fascinating subject, in its way, but not my specialty. It occurred to me that I might be able to ask the gods shortly in person after I was dead, but for the moment I wasn't. I didn't know what I was doing, but what I was doing was working if I wasn't dead. We were talking, even negotiating if you wanted to look at it that way. Perhaps there was a faint hope that we could reason with it.
I am the god of the valley now. The Humani gods are forever banished. The defilers of our sacred cave need to be punished.
Now we were in dangerous territory. They have lost their homes. Many have lost their families. Their lives will be chaos for the rest of their days. They will suffer nightly the dreams of their experience until they die. There will be hunger and suffering. Simply killing them would have ended their pain, I reasoned. From this they can never recover. Not a good time to talk about the resilience of the human spirit.
They are beyond my reach for the moment. Let them suffer. But you are still here. And you,
he said, turning the globe incrementally so that the dead eye stared at Kusi,
are the descendant of Sir Brandnut. It was a statement, not a question.
I have that honour,
said Kusi in a strong, proud voice. Your sire's face was the last thing I saw in my old life.
It was war,
Kusi said simply.
He did his duty as he saw fit. He was commanded to do it.
Your line owes me a debt for its treachery.
Kusi didn't say anything. He also didn't lower his sword, for all the good it would do him.
It was war, I repeated, when the silence grew too long. And this man was not even born then.
It matters not. His line owes me a debt. So he owes me a debt.
What could he possibly give you? He has nothing. All that he had, you took from him.
There was a short pause. Not all. He has his life. He owes it to me.
Killing him would end his suffering too, I offered, trying to buy the man a way out. Whatever crimes his sires committed, he himself was only guilty of defending his people and his lands.
His people? My lands?
Yet I will not murder him. Instead he shall serve me until his last heartbeat.
Never, Kusi said defiantly, and started to charge. He looked splendid in his armor, his device on the breast of his surcoat, every inch the Wilderlord knight prepared for battle. The fathers of his house would have been proud of him.
I will die before I serve you, foul beast!
Me? Not so much. He was a damn fool who was going to get us all killed. Insulting the undead goblin head wasn't going to help.
But Kusi followed the insult by charging, sword swinging.
No!
I shouted, and immediately began to fire a spell from my war wand. It was the least lethal of the ones I had hung. It was a short but powerful stunning spell, the kind of thing that's great for knocking over a cavalry squadron. I had it ready before Kusi had taken 5 steps, but I was too slow. The dead god had reached out with his mind and took over control of Kusi's body. My spell passed him harmlessly, though it gouged out a small crater in the earth behind him.
Let him go!
I shouted, smoking wand in hand.
He belongs to me now. I said, let him go!
Kusi's legs moved jerkily, until he was standing to the left of the globe. I tried to think of an appropriate spell, but I had nothing.
My lord captain, said Carmella warningly, is it not best that he live out his fate?
I agree, Min,
added Penny quickly.
He knew what might happen when he stayed behind the evacuation.
I can't allow that,
I said sternly, and advanced to within 3 paces of the dead god. What the hell was I doing? This was worse than facing the incarnation of death. As I approached, I got to see a little more detail of the undead goblin's face within the sphere of green amber. It was grotesque, just what you would imagine a 200-year-old fossilized and partially decomposed head of a goblin who died by violence might look like.
Let him go!
He is mine,
the voice said in my mind. It was disconcerting how it was no louder, now that I was close to it.
Stand away.
Instead, I stared intently at the sphere, committing every detail to memory.
He does not deserve this, I stated.
You are correct, but this is the worst punishment I can bestow. He deserves 1,000 times worse.
He is a good man who has done nothing but defend his people.
He is Sion of House Brandmount. I knew his great-grandsire. I spoke with him for days before he murdered me. He shares his sire's face. He himself has hunted my people and kept them away from the sacred cave. He has prevented the fulfillment of the prophecy.
What prophecy?
Shit. There was a prophecy. That could complicate things. Centuries ago, a great shaman, Ullar Telek, prophesied that we would lose the valley to the unclean, and that all of my people would be in danger.
The time was called the Exile, and it came to pass. Ulatelek also prophesied that the Great War would come, and for 4 generations all would be in chaos. All is doomed, he said, until the one Gervan who sees the cave first, after the exile, leads his people through the war and into a greater peace. I am the fulfillment of that prophecy. I alone shall lead my people to wipe yours back into the void.
Uh-oh. Genocidal prophecies. A maniacal undead god. A potent mystical portal. This was all leading someplace. The dead god was to be the savior of his people, because he would be the first Gervan to see the cave after the exile. Only he hadn't been. Gurkhal had that honor, and Shirul didn't know that. That had to be significant, somehow. Well, we wouldn't want to stand in the way of the fulfillment of prophecy, I said. Why don't you just let the night go, and we'll be on our way?
He belongs to me. His fate has been spoken. His life is forfeit. To the end of his days shall he serve me.
How much was I willing to push this? Enough to get us all killed for the life of one man who was prepared to die anyway? A man who had insulted and betrayed me? Before I answered my own question, I decided that it would be best to know exactly what the stakes were. If you take him, you would let the rest of us pass in peace.
He owes me a debt. I am deciding if you do as well.
What the hell did I do?
You slew my captains, killed my shamans.
They invaded our homes. It is the right of every being to defend their homes.
And it is the right of every conqueror to cleanse the lands of the conquered.
You might find that more difficult than you think, I said, starting to get pissed off a little. The dead god laughed inside my head, which was eerie when I could see his unmoving face through murky green amber.
Those pebbles you clutch are meaningless. They are the merest slivers of my power, cast off and given to the least of my servants.
But they no longer answer to you, I pointed out.
It matters not. 100 times as many would be useless against me. You are no threat, spellmonger.
How did you—
I can see inside your minds as well as speaking to them. For all of your vain glory, you are little better than a village witch, a pawn of your betters. You are no match for me. From inside your own eyes, I see. I know what spells you have prepared. Useless.
Let's hope we don't have to find out. I want safe passage for all of us, outside of the valley.
I want the last 2 centuries of suffering and exile to not have occurred. It appears we are both doomed to disappointment.
Perhaps. I thought you hadn't decided if we owed you a debt yet.
True. If I decide you don't, then I will grant you a quick death. If I decide you do, then your agony will encompass weeks before you are sacrificed to me.
That was a cheery thought. Then you realize what I'm going to have to do.
I look forward to it. It should prove entertaining, if naught else.
Last chance, I warned.
You try my patience.
Attack! I yelled in what I hoped was an impressive and inspirational voice, and loosed my 2 most powerful hung spells at once. I could feel everyone else's going off all around me, in what was the largest sudden release of magical energy I had ever been involved with in my life. Nothing happened. I don't mean that we didn't hit him, or that it didn't have an effect. I mean that time stopped, and suddenly I was standing in a forest of statues. And I wasn't alone. Around me, in front of me, a line of diminutive figures had suddenly appeared, each one holding a gnarled branch that doubled as a powerful magical implement, at least as potent as any wizard staff I'd seen. The tree folk had arrived. While I can't honestly say that they were the last folks I expected to see, they weren't high on the list. I knew that the Alka Alon had been watching us,
monitoring the situation as we dwindled away under the goblin onslaught. They were too good at magic not to notice that abomination, or all of the activity in their front garden. I had thought that they would have stayed away, quietly slipped out of the valley while they could. That's what I would have done. I did not honestly think that the Aronin would pitch in, else I would have tried harder to gain his alliance earlier. But there he was, he and a dozen or so of his court. They picked their way across the courtyard as normally as you could ask. It was everything else that was askew. My comrades were in various stages of flinging spells at the sphere, their arms raised and their mouths open. Sire Kusi was hanging in midair, frozen, a blank look on his face. Even the birds in the air were still, hung as if suspended from strings. The sphere wasn't moving, either. Not that it moved much before. Everything was frozen. Penny was an elegant statue, with a look of grim determination on her face, hands gracefully outstretched in mid-spell. Carmella had a mixture of fear and excitement on her face as she mouthed the trigger of her own attack. Talaman and Wenick were charging, mage blades flashing. Taran was shouting a war cry. Hesia was flinging something from her staff. But all around me, everyone was petrified, suspended in the moment. Except for me.
Huh? What?
Minilan the Spellmonger, the priest king called, and stepped gracefully across the pockmarked courtyard, as if he was out on a nature hike.
It is good to see you again. Yeah. You too, my lord Aronin. I take it you were in the neighborhood? We have been watching you for weeks now. We knew you would provide us an opportunity to strike.
You did? I did, I asked. Confused. He gestured toward the malevolent sphere.
We knew the abomination would seek to engage you personally. Sharul has a thirst for vengeance too strong to do otherwise. It kept him distracted. You kept his army at bay for weeks longer than he had planned, and longer than I had expected for a human mage. We knew you would mount a defense. We had to wait for the encounter before we struck at the abomination.
Why? I asked, open-mouthed. A couple of weeks ago, we might have had a chance with your support. But now?
Because as much as it troubles me to say, the welfare of your people was not our foremost thought. It pleases me mightily that you have found a way to preserve them. We did not expect you to make use of the Molopar so readily.
I didn't think the Alka'alon were able to be surprised. He broke into a smile that was overwhelmingly good-natured and calm, under the circumstances.
Surprise is a novelty we don't enjoy often. It happens rarely, and when it does, it is noteworthy. We waited for the right moment, the moment when he was distracted, and his defenses were canted towards human magics, before we chose to attack.
I looked around. Well, glad we could oblige. How are you doing this? I asked, gesturing around.
This close to the Molopar, such song spells are simple for those who have studied them for centuries. In essence, we have slowed time. It was one of the few things we did not think he would expect or be able to counter.
So, you have a plan? I asked, hopefully.
We do. We will surround the abomination and weave a web of energy around it, such as hasn't been attempted in living memory, and the memory of my folk, not just you ephemerals. This is not the first time this has happened.
I stared blankly.
Beg pardon?
You mean magically reanimated goblin heads aren't the novelty I suspected?
The Gavani have never tried this, but the technique occurs in nature. You are aware, of course, that Irionite is the result of Kelisarth sap crystallizing.
Yes, I suppose. I could see how it would happen, from a theoretical perspective. The glowing green globe that wanted to see all of humanity wiped off of Kalador was proof of the concept. Occasionally, an insect or small animal gets entrapped into the matrix. When that happens, the creature's will can reassert itself, only magically.
The Enneagram of its self-awareness is frozen, but accessible with sufficient power.
The poor creature is usually driven mad, of course, unable to escape its essential nature, but unable to realize the potential it enjoys. We call such aberrations Kulnuara. They often go on to cause much destruction and havoc, and have to be brought to bay. So how do you defeat a Kulnuara? I asked. Please tell me it's a simple and trivial piece of conjuration. The Aronin shook his head sadly. It is exceedingly difficult, even when the animal involved is simple. Sometimes armies of my folk have been sent against the beasts, and been slain before they were able to control it. In this case, we face someone who knows what they are, who knows how to sing magic, and who revels in their power. This is no ordinary Kulnuara. He looked at the sphere, the first time I ever saw one of the tree folk truly look grim. The three usual ways to counter a common Kulnuara are to sap its power utterly, to bend it against itself until it can no longer hold the strain, or attack the integrity of the physical object itself. We shall attempt the second measure. The power is too great to attempt to draw it off, and the sphere is quite massive. Should we manage to break it open, there will likely be enough crystal left within the skull to counter any further moves we make. So we shall turn its own power against itself. I sighed. This should be fun to watch. No, Spellmonger. You shall not be here to witness our battle. The way he said it left no room for doubt. We won't survive the fights, I take it. Well, I expected no less. You misunderstand. Your presence here would be a distraction. And we have further work for you to do. I beg your pardon? Someone who understands what is involved must organize the defense of men, Spellmonger. Else the human world will be destroyed. As the Sherul, the dead god, gains power. You must go to the councils of men and tell them what you know. You must organize your dukes and lords into a defense against his armies, most of all. Your magics are crude and elementary, and they must be strengthened and organized against the Govani tide, else man will be washed away from the shores of Kalador, just as my own folk will likely be. You sound like you aren't planning on winning this contest. Yet it must be fought. We must be prepared, our two peoples. This is the first step. We must find a way to destroy Sherul. This is not a certain thing. It bears much risk. It is very powerful. Far more than we anticipated. And his stunted enneagram shows little sign of fading. Fueled by the power of his Irionite casing. The abomination is far more potent than we anticipated, he said sadly. We may well fall before he is defeated. But even if we are victorious, there is still the matter of his misguided hordes, who loathe my folk for the past wrongs they perceive almost as much as they do yours. Should the dead god fall, his followers will be leaderless. Weaker, but still very destructive. They will come after your people until they are ground to a halt. Defenses must be erected against them, lest your fractured nations fail the challenge of their vengeance. Win or lose, this great army will issue forth from this valley as your folk left the sky, and they will drive the Humani in front of them. Those who are not killed or consumed. Thankfully, your folk rejoice in battle. And the effort will be celebrated by the survivors in song and story. That is not the kind of song or story I like. They will offer no quarter, and will slaughter or enslave every human they encounter, we believe. They will bring forth flame and steel, and magics most terrible. They will brandish weapons not seen in ages of men. They will seek to turn the weak-willed to their bidding, and use man's own power against him. If you value your race, a great line of defense must be erected against their assault, and that is if we are victorious. It is your charge to see to that. Why would anyone listen to me? I asked, raising an eyebrow. I'm a spellmonger with an illegal shard of Irionite. The first censor I see will kill me.
because you will make your case with such passion and conviction that you will crush any opposition. You will provide such a great and noble example of humanity and nobility that thousands will be inspired to defend human lands. More foresight? I asked, hopefully. He shook his head.
Nay, you just seem like that pushy kind of man.
Ishi's tits. Thanks, I said weakly. You will not be unaided. Your friends here will follow you unquestionably, and there will be others. As you work, the lore of your ancients will prove helpful. Perhaps alliances with the other Alon will sprout. My own folk will do what we can to aid you, but you alone should be sufficient to rally the human lands for this crisis. You have a pretty high opinion of my abilities, Aronin, and an imperfect understanding of ducal politics. He shrugged, which looked strange on him. Their shoulders were so narrow. As you did here, we use what we have available.
I see. Okay, I'm not going to argue the whole escape plan, because I've wanted to flee this place for weeks. But how about my people? The other war magi?
All shall be rescued. They will be needed in the coming days. All save that one, he said, nodding toward Kusi. Why not the Lord of Beauvoir Vale?
He is trapped within a powerful song, spellmonger, one which we shall not have the strength to breach while we struggle against the abomination. Lord Brandmount was a good and noble man, and I have watched him grow since he was a baby in this vale. But his life will be forfeit in this struggle. Knowing him as I do, he would not object to the sacrifice.
You know, Sire Kusi.
I have lived in this vale more than 11 lives of men. I have seen him grow from a babe to an old man. There is little that happens here I do not know.
Well, you're probably right. He is a noble sort of cuss. He wouldn't mind dying, not if it helped end this menace. But it's hardly the glorious death of a Wilderlord in battle. So, how are we getting away?
Here, he said, sketching a circle in the air about 10 feet across. The magic from his little wand was palpable. In other times I might open our ways to you, but this close to the Molopar a more effective song beckons. In a few moments this portal will open and lead you and your people outside of the valley. Not as far as you did with the Molopar, but beyond the greater invasion, and out of harm's way.
Great. I really appreciate it.
You will earn your passage. This spell of time will fade shortly, and when it does, you must lead your men against the sphere, just as you had planned. You must keep it distracted a moment while our song spell comes into play. Only then you will flee.
And you?
I will fight. Perhaps I will die. But I must make the attempt. That is what an Aronin does, he said, looking toward Kusi sympathetically. In our own way, we are as dedicated to our cause as your will the Lord is to his position. My guardianship is important, but this takes precedence. For once this valley was a holy place, even before the Garvani adopted it. Amadia is but a remnant of that age of wonder. What the dead god would turn it into would defile even the memory of that time.
Why don't you just move on? Escape with your people.
He smiled faintly. My people left Amadia weeks ago. My daughter Amaras led them away, and will inherit my traditional responsibilities as guardian when I am gone. The leaders of the other kindreds of my folk will not be pleased with this, of course, for they may see it as an abrogation of my responsibility. It is not. Amaras knows her duties. This valley is my home. Like Sire Kusi, I would rather die than see it turned into a dead wasteland. Even the Alka Alon were, in the end, stubborn villagers when faced with inevitable doom that threatened their home.
I don't know what to say. I almost wish I could stay and help.
Nay, you must leave. You and your people are destined to be the core of a great new army, an army that can beat back this tide, an army that you will lead.
The gods themselves will follow you, if you let them. It must persist and persevere, and fight until there is no more danger from our cousins. You must lead them, Minilin. No one else. Only you have the talent, will, and capacity to do what needs to be done. You and your children shall become the founders of a great line, should you succeed. That was good news. Except I didn't want to lead an army. I wanted to settle down and make babies. Not for the first time I considered how little my wishes mattered to the will of the rest of the universe. There is more. When the time is ripe, in its fullness, you will seek out my daughter Amaras, who even now seeks a place of refuge for the rest of my folk. I have given to her certain things that may assist you. Arcane secrets, you would call them. Things the other kindreds of the Alka'alon would not grant you, even in the most dire of circumstances. Things from our past. Things that nearly destroyed us once, and imperiled our place on Kalador. She has agreed to act as my messenger in this. Her word will hold great weight in the councils of the Alka'alon. Seek her when you can find no other way. Again, you're not sounding optimistic. I wish that I could be, Spellmonger, but I fear I will never see my daughter again in this life. I'll tell her you said hello, I said, which was a stupid thing to say, but I was long past the influence of inspiration. He smiled. Please do. Now prepare yourself, for you have a long and difficult journey ahead. Thanks, Aronin. May Brigga guide your magics, and may Trigg keep you and your new family safe in your travels, he responded amiably. Wait, you know about Alia, and the baby? As I said, I know of everything that happens in this valley. Are you now prepared? Our time is nearly at an end. Hells no. I heaved a great sigh and raised my wand and staff. I suppose, I lied, though I didn't know how I could become more prepared. While we had been talking, Mor Alka'alon had gathered around us. His folk formed a loose ring around the malevolent green sphere, and were establishing a net of power around it with strange and beautiful yet warlike songs. With a nod that they, too, were ready, he closed his eyes. And suddenly the world came back. It went from near silence, with not even the sounds of wind or trees rustling, to a loud, explosive chaos. I bellowed the release mnemonic on my own spell and sent them towards the sphere, and then followed with another as fast as I was able. Every ounce! I screamed into the magical tempest. Hold nothing back! What? Someone near me shouted as, to him, a ring of tree folk suddenly appeared between us and Sherul, hands outstretched, wands ready, their web of magic instantly in place. They continued singing, a beautiful, soulful song, the words of which I couldn't make out. I fired another spell instead, the last of my prepared offensive charms. Then I shouted encouragement to the others and watched that section of space that was our getaway. Trying to keep my eyes on three things at once was difficult, but I managed to spot the, call it a dull area in space, exactly where the Aronin had sketched it. The reality around the edges thinned out, until they melted into a greyness, and then formed a lovely picture of a forest glen where none had a right to be. "Time to go, folks!" I called. "Prepare to disengage and follow me!" The sphere was shaking and vibrating as the tree folk adepts spun web after elegant web around it. As soon as it would throw one of them off, another soon came back and added more bonds of power. It kept him from laying waste to us all, which was all right with me. My people were throwing an impressive amount of magical energy at the sphere, but it was hard with so many tree folk in the way. I screamed at them to withdraw and retreat through the sudden portal. They listened when they realized that the focus of the dead god's attention was not on us. One by one they fell back, and as they did so, I motioned them through the portal. Penny even grabbed Traveler's reins and took him through. I stayed to witness the battle as long as I was able to. Some of his folk fell, but not the Aronin. Not until the last. I felt compelled to watch as long as I could, even though Pentandro was screaming for me to step through the portal before it was too late. I was reluctant. The Aronin of Amadia's brilliant attack and willful sacrifice should be witnessed by someone, after all. The last thing I saw before I stepped through the shrinking disk was his face, focused in concentration and determination, with just a hint of laughter and desperation thrown in, as he unleashed a fresh wave of magic against the abomination of the dead god. I suppressed the urge to run to his side and add my feeble powers to his against the eternally screaming goblin he faced. But Pentandra grabbed the back of my tunic and pulled me through the portal. Then I was gone. Chapter 16. Escape from Beauvon. The only thing you could charitably say about the little village of Duprin was that it didn't have much of a goblin population. The Aronin did the best he could, I'm sure, under very difficult circumstances. We were well outside of the dead god's malevolent influence, but we were also in one of the most backwoods fiefdoms in all of the southern Alshari wilderlands. Still, the local folk, all 300 of them, and the local lord, who was a country knight, welcomed the coin we brought. We needed all sorts of supplies if we were to make the long journey towards civilization, and we probably flooded Duprin with more hard currency than they'd ever seen in their lifetime. The people of Duprin were a little disconcerted at first by 20-odd war magi appearing out of nowhere. The local priestess of Trigg was called in to verify that we were not, in fact, demons of some kind, and after getting a clean bill of metaphysical health from the old biddy, we started spending like sailors. Food, horses, saddles, tack, and wains. We needed just about everything. We were almost 900 leagues away from the rest of the survivors at Inarion, but we were also over 250 leagues away from Beauvol Vale. We wanted some rest. The last few days had been heady, busy, and exhausting. Doing magic, even augmented by the stones, takes a lot out of you physically and mentally, and without a good rest, we would have eventually fallen out of our saddles. Oh, we could have re-energized ourselves magically, but that way lies madness. The likelihood that we would soon grow dependent upon the stones was too great. A couple of days taking it easy at Duprin before we moved on were just what we needed. Rumors of goblin invasion north of here were already starting to filter in, but we didn't spread them. We had more important things to do, like sleep. Late in the second day, Penny and I met up for a late breakfast or early lunch at the tiny, nameless inn at the heart of the village. The fare was simple and rustic, a thick venison stew with tubers and grain, some passable bread and some cheese we passed up in favour of some of the last Bovali cheese that would ever be produced. But the beer was excellent, and I had several mugs. Penny ate as daintily as she would have at court, whereas I mostly just shoveled it in as fast as I could chew. We were comparing notes about our big spell, our typical post-coital post-mortem, when she put her hand on mine, stopping me in mid-thought.
"Min," she asked, "what do we do now?"
"Huh? Well, I'm thinking about a pie. I smell blueberry pie. I love pie," I avowed. "It's in the blood."
"No, you idiot. Not lunch. I mean, what do we do now?"
"Well, after we get our supplies together and enough horses that won't fall over dead under a saddle, we'll take the east road to Verenal, where we hire a barge, then go south along..."
"You're completely hopeless, you know that? I mean, what do we do now about the dead god? Sharul, the great ghost?"
"Oh, him. Right. Run. Hide. Fight. What else can we do?"
"We have to raise the duchies against him,"
she declared quietly. "We can turn over some valuable military intelligence to the proper authorities. What they do with it isn't our concern, or our responsibility, no matter what," the Aronin said. "They're dukes and counts. I'm sure they'll think of something. Besides, we're magi, remember? We're prohibited by the bans from interfering with politics." She shook her head and stared off into the forest.
"No, all of those old rules, they'll be thrown out after this."
I made a face. "You can't throw out the bans.
They're the only magical regulation we've had for 400 years. The censorate won't let you. Nonetheless, they are outmoded and archaic, she quietly insisted. They will be overturned. Between the Irianite and the dead god, the bands aren't going to work anymore. More, we'll have to use our influence to push the Coronet Council to take a comprehensive approach to this invasion. I shrugged. Duke Lengin of Alshar is mobilizing his troops at the summer capital at Verone, I hear. I assume the ducal court mage has been informed. There will be a meeting. What more could they do? She rolled her eyes.
You can be so dumb sometimes.
Yeah, barbarian peasant, remember? Dumb, ignorant, and fiercely proud of it.
That's part of the problem,
she said, her mouth full of apple.
You're looking at this from a peasant's point of view.
Oh, you can see it from a professional standpoint too, I suppose, but your reaction is pure peasant. I like peasants, I defended. They're cute and uncomplicated.
Don't we all?
But a peasant looks at the world as if he has little choice and little chance to change anything outside of the village level. If a crisis occurs, his first inclination is to find a lord to help or blame, looking towards the nobility for guidance and leadership. Aren't the nobility supposed to be our guides and leaders?
Yes,
but they are such mostly because they take the initiative to lead. When an intelligent peasant takes that kind of initiative, they either kill him or raise him to the nobility. The point is, peasants look to nobles for leadership, policy and guidance. Where do you think the nobility turns?
The gods, I supplied. Hells, I didn't know.
Thank the gods they don't, Penny said, rolling her eyes. Theocracies are hell, a sign of a diseased culture. For who speaks for the gods but the temples? And the temples have their own agendas that have little to do with the gods.
No, the nobles look to each other, to themselves. They agitate and conspire and plot and plan. They may have good intentions or ill, be competent or incompetent, but they have put forth an effort to use their power and resources to advance the causes they choose to serve.
I thought they just spent rent money and ran the courts.
And the military, and the bureaucracy, and 100 other things, if they choose. Or they can sit in a castle and play checkers and wait to be bred. But if they excel, it is because they put forth the effort and forged ahead to do what needed to be done.
And the dirt farmer, tenant, or serf, who cuts yet another acre of farmland out of the swamp? He doesn't.
It's not a matter of effort, Min. It's a matter of resources. The nobles can make themselves rich, true. But what does that wealth represent?
Jeweled daggers and crystal chamber pots.
Those are symptoms. That wealth is power.
Oh, they have the power of their position, of course. The special considerations.
But the difference between Sir Turdfoot, or wherever the hells we are, and ambitious Count Sparky, High Councillor of the Exchequer, is that Sparky was able to use his estates and money to gain power, while Turdfoot scrapes by not much better off than his peasants.
So wealth is power. You aren't telling me anything I don't know. If you have the wealth, you make the laws.
No,
she said patiently.
If you have the power, you can make the laws. That is, you can make policy, codified into law. Money is one form of power, but there are others. And power isn't static, it's fluid. It changes form based on the situation. If things got dire in the castle under siege, which would have been more powerful? The noble with a sack of gold, or the peasant with a side of beef?
If the peasant could hang on to the beef, I grumbled.
Exactly. Military power is another kind of power. A very blatant kind. But it isn't absolute. The realm suffers when it's run by pure military power. What other kinds of power are there?
She asked, the patronizing tones rising in her voice. The power of, well, you mentioned the temples?
Yes, that's right. The temples can wield great power, for they can motivate the masses to ignore self-preservation in the name of a holy cause. They have moral power as well, ideally. But most are run by petty people with odd ideas about a civil society.
So, you said money, so I guess trade is out.
Nope,
she said, shaking her head.
Trade is different. Trade is money on the move.
A noble can sit on his fat ass in a castle and collect rents, and accumulate power that way. But he can't exercise the power until he spends the money. On crystal chamber pots, sometimes, but mostly on the upkeep of defences, the maintenance of his men, buying arms, armour, horses, a thousand other things that have to go from one end of the world to the other. This wonderful, lamented cheese, for instance. In Ramir, it costs almost 100 times what it costs in Beauval. Who do you think took the difference?
The cheese merchant and the carter?
Actually, about 2 dozen people had their hand in the transaction, I'd guess, including all the nobles who taxed it along the way, and the people who maintained the roads.
So what? Cheese is power too.
Trade is power. The cheese stops rolling. All those people lose their cut. If they lose their cut, they complain.
So complaining is power?
Yes, actually it is. When you complain that your trade isn't working, you motivate your nobility to do something about it, or else the mercantile interests will arrange for there to be a noble in place who will.
So cheese power trumps military power.
You are rutting impossible, you know that? Trade is great power. All these people along that route are going to exercise their power to complain, or, in extremes, withhold taxes, until they put enough pressure to get something done. The more efficient the trade, the more money is made, and the more power it exercises.
What about magic? You imperial types saw it as all the rage once.
Magical power is real power too, she admitted, but not the way you think it is. The magocracy ruled as an imperial power, because the magical and the military made a potent combination and allowed the mercantile interests to go pretty much where they wanted to and make a lot of money. Magic gave them an edge, of course, but it was in technological sophistication that led to a higher standard of living and afforded them such power.
Until we Narasi barbarians came along, I said proudly.
No, actually. We were doomed before then. Magic was a potent force only if it was used, and when that idiot confiscated all of the Irionite and dumped it in the waves over lost Perwin, he shackled the very thing that gave him power.
But he kept plenty of Irionite for himself, I countered.
But the magocracy was not designed to run on any one house's talent or one man's. Magical power can only be used as a tool of real power when the situation is such that mere military or commercial means of influence are ineffective. That war in Faris you can't shut up about, for example.
Wasn't that the last remnant of the magocracy? I asked, teasingly.
Shut up. Oral Pratt was the last great imperial mage outside of the bands, but his temporal power was entirely situational. He was the power behind the Doge, who was a merchant prince. Pratt was only able to exercise power because he had Irionite and could harm the mercantile competition, the duchies. Similarly, the Archmage only held temporal power because he could use his magic against the heathen barbarians and keep them on the steps where they belong.
Yeah. How's that coming? I asked innocently.
Shut up! Magical power is usually situational. The problem was that the magocracy was designed to run on several houses competing good-naturedly for the privilege of power by virtue of what service they could perform to extend and secure trade routes. When the competition got too rowdy and a mage war broke out, the Archmage was supposed to intervene and use his power to compel the combatants to work for the benefit of the magocracy. He wasn't supposed to have all the power. When the Imperial House claimed a monopoly on the last few shreds of Irionite, the great magical houses were all hopelessly subordinate, and so they didn't even try to help the defense of the magocracy the way they should have. Without the power to protect trade, or the will to use it, magical power became a weak footnote in the collapse of the magocracy, instead of its savior.
Conquest of the magocracy, you mean?
Shut up! The point is, you take away the barbarians on the steps, and the pirates that threaten shipping, and the magocracy ceases to have power based on magic, unless you count the magic of bureaucracy.
A dark and evil force, if there ever was one, I added helpfully.
And that is my point. The game has shifted, and suddenly some idiot peasant spellmonger has been given a tremendous amount of power,
And because the dead god has entered the picture, your magical power suddenly means something. The ability to protect trade routes and suppliers.
I thought we were saving the world from ancient evil goblins, I asked, confused.
We are, she agreed. For the mercantile interests.
Oh, is that good? And how do I have all this power again?
Okay. I'll try to use small words. Look at it this way. With the troops the dead god has on hand right at the moment, he can easily assault Alshar and overrun the Wilderlands. By this time next year, he'll control at least half of the duchy, probably more. And even with every sword in the realm riding at his bidding, the Duke will still lose in nearly every battle where there isn't an augmented war mage or six, war magi armed with witch stones. You have the Irionite. That's power. Politics,
I sang, reminding her of the bans against such things.
You want to know about politics? Here's a lesson. When Sir Kay and the rest of the survivors are able to finally present their case to the Duke and his council, there will be days and days of discussion in court about how reliable the accounts of such traumatized backwoods nobility and rustic peasants are. Obviously, it will be said, they are overstating the matter, embellishing on the truth, in order to advance their own goals. Never mind that all these people just lost their homes and appeared at Inarion out of thin air. That won't matter. What will matter is that the ducal bureaucracy, which creaks along like frozen honey in the best of circumstances, will dig in its heels and do everything it can to ignore the truth in favour of the status quo.
Penny, they aren't that stupid, I said, shaking my head.
Wanna bet? Min, the only difference between the Ducal Council, or the Coronet Council for that matter, and a Shoemaker's Guild, is that the Shoemakers will probably have a better organization and less political consideration on their side. Other than that, you have the same issues you have in any organization. Everyone trying to protect their piece of the pie at the expense of everyone else.
So it all comes back to pie, I said sagely.
Pay attention, she demanded. The Ducal Council will hem and haw while the local and regional lords in the west get slaughtered as they try to take on the goblins piecemeal. By the time the hordes are at the Verone, they will slowly start realizing that they are in trouble, mostly because their tax revenues are down over last year. Then they will start to creak into action, but not very efficiently. They will argue and debate and compromise for political expediency when by all rights they should appoint a war leader and get to business. Else there will be four duchies next year.
That seems overly pessimistic, I noted.
It's overly realistic, actually, she sighed. This is simple. If you had any familiarity with Rhaemaran politics...
Okay. For the sake of argument, let's say you are correct, and the Duke's people won't be able to get their heads out of their asses. What the hells can we do?
We can take our case to them. Convince them.
First the Duke of Alshar, then the entire Coronet Council, or better yet, the Duke of Castol, Rard. Because I'm so damn cute and persuasive.
No,
because you are in charge of the most powerful magical strike team ever assembled, and Rard is looking to expand his influence beyond Castol. His wife is the sister of Duke Lengine, and they both want more power. By all accounts, they are utter opportunists. That gives you a certain degree of leverage. You have the only stone that can break the dead god's influence over other captured shards. That gives you a unique power. How many stones do you have left, unclaimed?
About nine, I admitted. And those give you significantly more leverage. Each one is worth about a barony, in mundane terms. You'll give those stones to magi who can make a difference, won't you?
She said. A statement, not a question. I answered anyway. Well, yeah, I suppose. I'm sure the Duke can find...
Screw the Duke, she said bitterly. You don't understand how power works. Political power. The Duke sets policy. He approves laws. He sets style. He hires other people to enforce his decisions. He keeps the realm safe. That is the sum total of his power. To set policy, he listens to advisers. He must have laws proposed if he is to approve them.
He needs direction before he can appoint the proper people to execute them. That includes the court wizard and all the other ducal posts. And that means he needs wise counsel. And in this situation, you are surely the wisest counsel he can hope to hear from. So, we go forth boldly and demand an audience, tell it like it is, and then use your accumulated influence to convince him to form policy to our liking.
And that would be
raising the duchies, ishies, tits your dim. Every single duchy will have to send troops, weapons, supplies, magi. You name it, we'll need it. This is going to be a long war. That's the best case. Worst case? Alshar is Sherul's new summer home, and the eastern duchies get to fight against him at half strength and lose.
Pen, even at full strength, will probably lose. She sagged.
I know, but we have to try. And you're the only man who can do it.
What about Turlaman? I protested. Or you, for that matter.
We've all pledged to follow you.
You did what?
Who did? Follow who? When?
Sorry you didn't hear the announcement, she said dryly. We had a meeting while you were sleeping the night before last. Every one of us knows what is going to happen. Apparently we're smarter than you. And